The Mendocino Complex Fire, the cluster of wildfires burning northwest of Sacramento and Northern California, is now the biggest wildfire in the state's recorded history. About 150 miles away, the Carr Fire is still burning near Redding. 7 people have died in that fire so far. We saw similarly massive and destructive fires in 2017. Before Mendocino, the biggest fire in the state's history was the Thomas Fire, which burned last December across Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. 2 people died and more than 1,000 structures were destroyed. 21 people died in related mudslides. Just a few months before that, the North Bay was devastated by a series of wildfires that left 44 people dead and thousands of homes destroyed. And there's a phrase that Governor Jerry Brown and other state officials have been using.
This is kind of the new normal.
The Golden State is truly facing a new normal when it comes to wildland fire events.
With extreme weather events becoming the new normal.
Fires are now part of our ordinary experience.
Maybe we thought we were done in October, and again, California, this changed, this new normal.
To this new normal.
These kind of fires are now the new normal.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And today on the show, we look at how we got to this so-called new normal and what that means for how human beings respond to wildfires in the future. And here to help us is Stephen Strader, assistant professor of geography and the environment at Villanova University.
We always have to be careful with the language that we use to describe sort of how climate change is influencing our environment. The new normal to the general public means one thing, but looking at it from a scientific and statistical standpoint, these changes that we're seeing with the environment, specifically with wildfires and other hazards, it's more complicated than that. There's also some variability that we're seeing where we might have one year where there's a lot of fires and another year where there's hardly any at all. So it's not just that we're seeing an increase, but there could also be some year-to-year variability that is also changing. And that's also a result of climate and environmental changes that we're just now starting to realize going into the next 30, 40 years.
So we hear a lot about climate change, and this is something that is debated. It's a hot political issue. But your argument is that these fires are also being caused by something a little bit more than strictly climate change, right? Don't we have something to do with it as humans?
Yeah, that's correct. And the way that we think about disasters like wildfires or tornadoes or tropical storms is we really wouldn't care about them if they didn't affect people. So when we think about disasters, we have to take the hazard itself into consideration, the wildfire, and how that might be changing over time. In other words, are wildfires becoming more common and larger? But the other side of the coin, of the disaster coin, if you will, is how society's changing. If you think back to what the city you grew up in or a small city you visited 30, 40 years ago, it was smaller. And now if you go there today, it's enlarged. It's expanded over time. And there's more people, more things than ever before. So out west, what we're seeing is places where they didn't used to have homes 30, 40 years ago now have homes. And unfortunately, this interaction where wildfires have always been and where people are now are leading to greater and greater disasters in terms of numbers and magnitude as well.
So is it strictly the presence of people that's causing this, or is it something more than that? Is it development? Is it a combination of different things? Is it residents who aren't environmentally aware of how they should take care of their community? What exactly is the danger here of this population increase and, by extension, the fires that we're seeing?
Yeah, so the way I like to think about it on terms or in terms of the effects that humans have on sort of maybe wildfire disasters is there's indirect and direct effects. The direct would be that because there's more people visiting places that are prone to wildfires or living there, the odds of them igniting a wildfire are greatly increased. Humans are still the leading cause and continuing to cause more and more wildfires. The other indirect effect is that there's people, new subdivisions that have been built that are now affected when a wildfire does occur. So it's this sort of combination of how climate change might be driving the conditions for wildfires, but humans are the ones igniting them, and humans are the ones being affected by them more and more because we're living in places we've never lived before. We have more homes, we have more people, or more things in our lives to be destroyed by wildfires, unfortunately.
It almost reminds me a little bit of when Hurricane Sandy hit New York and New Jersey and our region over here, and how after structures and houses were destroyed, people decided to just go right back and rebuild. Is that part of, could that make this worse if people are being, are saying we're going to go back to these areas that have been burned out and just continue to rebuild? I mean, should people be thinking about moving to other areas? Is it that an issue, or do they, or should they be allowed to continue building on these areas that are obviously sensitive?
That's a really great comment. And the reason it is we sort of have coined this, my research group and I, sort of thinking about this as disaster amnesia. And it's almost like we see this time and time again with Sandy, with tornadoes, we see it with wildfires, is the desire that when a hazard or a disaster does occur, they want to rebuild and get back to the status quo. Unfortunately, we see this most of the time in areas that are prone to flooding, areas that get flooded time and time again, and we rebuild right back to the same locations. So it's almost like there's an amnesia there. And there's no incentive really to leave right now in those disaster-prone areas. So people want to get back to their lives. It's very difficult for us to say, you can't live here anymore because it's prone to flooding or prone to, you know, hurricane storm surge. Unfortunately, it may be the best solution for certain types of hazards. But how we justify that and how we enforce that goes against some of the very things that most of us and the freedoms and things that we've been shared as Americans are basically going right into the face of that. So it's a very difficult concept to grasp, but in some ways that is what we would need to do. And unfortunately, a lot of times if you look at the Florida coast, the East Coast, there are disasters waiting to happen because of how we build up against areas that are prone to hazards.
What can really be done here at a policy level? We talked about people, but it sounds like it's going to be hard to get people to stop moving into certain neighborhoods. So what can be done at a policy level to mitigate some of these fires?
Well, to sort of bring it back to the wildfires, each one of these hazards is different, whether it's flooding, it's tornadoes, whatever. They all have their own little niche that require certain types of actions. So it unfortunately makes my life as a hazard scientist more difficult, but it takes a team of people to solve these issues. But it also is encouraging to sort of get together as a team and think about where we're going to be in the next 100 years. And that's important to me as a young scientist.
Stephen Strader is an assistant professor of geography and the environment at Villanova University. Dr. Strader, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard how human development and climate change are setting the stage for more devastating wildfires in California. Those fires also worsen air quality in a state which, according to a new study by the American Lung Association, has 8 of the 10 most polluted cities in the country. Last week, California faced another setback in addressing air quality. President Trump announced his administration plans to roll back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for the auto industry. California has tried to make its air cleaner over the decades, partly by becoming a national leader on fuel efficiency. But for years, the state has used a special waiver to force automakers to meet its own state standards. But Trump's proposal takes direct aim at the Golden State. Chip Jacobs is the co-author of Smogtown, the lung-burning history of pollution in Los Angeles, and he joins me now to talk about how a state suffering from smoke, smog, and ash can survive. Chip, can California survive this?
We can survive it. We'll just be coughing a lot more. Over the years, we've seen our pollution levels really drop at a staggering rate because our sort of passive environmentalism here, where we allow ourselves to be taxed, as well as better technology. What's a little alarming is in the last years, we've seen ozone, which is one of the prime ingredients in air pollution or smog, starting to go back up. And it feels like we're backsliding against a lot of progress.
Well, one question I have as a New Yorker who drives only when absolutely positively necessary, the question I have is, to what extent in California, a state that you have to drive in, do recent automobile emissions and wildfires actually contribute to California's poor air quality?
Automobile driving here is infamous. About 40% of greenhouse gases, I believe, come from the cars. We're like the leading source of greenhouse gases now. So it's a vicious cycle. You know, Los Angeles, California, to some extent, we're built on the freeway culture. We're not a public transit culture like the East Coast. We once were, but we no longer are. And we're sort of just still sticking with the freeway mindset. And yet we're finding as the temperatures go up, it's that we create this daisy chain of bad news for Mother Nature, where ozone creeps up. We've had the last 5 years have been the hottest in the last 124 years of record keeping. So when we produce a lot of carbon dioxide, it creates more conditions for ozone. When there's more conditions for ozone, that's when people get sick and are coughing, and certain people are in danger of very serious health problems. So we're dependent on the car, and we're also vulnerable to the effects of climate change.
So it seems like
it's a tricky dance.
Right. And Chip, these two things that are conflating here, the increase in the amount of fires in the state, as well as the rollbacks on these Obama-era fuel efficiency standards, seem to potentially be creating a perfect storm, no pun intended, for potentially more fires and worse air quality for Californians.
That's true, but I will bet you a New York slice of pizza that Trump administration will never get remove California's ability to set its own emission standards. California is just too big, too powerful politically, even though it's a blue state. Sometimes people in Washington are a little afraid to mess with California with something so essential. This waiver has been on the books since Ronald Reagan was in office. It was extremely hard fought. We wouldn't have done it actually without the state of New York and Robert Kennedy back then lobbying for us. That's when our smog was so bad. We had smog alerts effectively every 2 out of 3 days. So it's going to be very difficult for them to beat California and other attorney generals. And you know what? The logic is so faulty that they're tripping over it themselves, the people in the White House. So I'm very skeptical they'll get this through. I think it's more of a bargaining position. And what's odd is they're pushing for fuel efficiency standards the car makers don't even really want. So it's, I don't know what their philosophy is, but I know one thing. They're not out here living California, in terms of the environment.
Right. The car makers have actually moved ahead a little bit with this technology. And Chip, I did hear your New York slice of pizza bet there. So just a reminder, it's eaten folded and standing. Chip Jacobs is the co-author of Smogtown, The Lung-Burning History of Pollution in Los Angeles. Chip, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, at least 74 people were shot over the course of a 63-hour window that ended early Monday morning in the city of Chicago. The shootings, which mostly took place in the city's south and west side neighborhoods, left 12 people dead. An angry Mayor Rahm Emanuel addressed the press on Monday.
We have a heavy heart. Our souls are burdened. What happened this weekend did not happen in every neighborhood in Chicago, but it is unacceptable to happen in any neighborhood of Chicago.
Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston is the pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church and the president of the Coalition for a New Chicago, and he joined me to talk about the reaction among the communities dealing with this gun violence on a regular basis.
One, they're numb, and it's become somewhat normative to them. The second is they're afraid, and they're becoming numb to basically try to deal with the great fear they have of being shot, walking down the street, standing on their steps, or just sitting in their house and a bullet coming through the window. So it's pretty rough.
Now, let's be clear which communities are being affected by this majority. Are we talking about working class communities, black and brown communities? Who is being affected by this gun violence?
The challenge in the disadvantaged communities that are black and brown, that are working class, that are poor, are being affected by this because Chicago has been intentionally segregated. And when you intentionally segregate a people, two things happen, insulation and desperation. There is insulation for folk with the assets, and there is desperation for the folk without the assets.
Let's talk a little bit about what provoked some of the violence, if we know. Are these strategic issues or attacks, or is this just indiscriminate violence?
So much of it is indiscriminate, and by that I mean you have a lot of what we call renegades. These are young men and some women as well who are part of a gang in name only because the gangs have no leaders in many ways in Chicago right now. And sometimes what people tend to not know if you don't have boots on the ground, many of them live in places with no air conditioning, no working toilets. You'd be surprised. They have buckets in their house. And so you have people living in these less than 21st century standards of humaneness, and they're outside and it's 100 degrees and things get rough and heavy. And oftentimes the gangs are formed because people are trying to find a way, and again, I'm not condoning, but these street organizations are formed because they're trying to find a way to develop alternative economies to get power and to be able to get the assets that oftentimes segregation denied them.
So I want to play a clip from Rahm Emanuel's press conference yesterday, and this is the Chicago Police Department Superintendent Eddie Johnson talking about the need for the community to be a part of the solution.
We need the community and community leaders to work with us. We need parents to be parents. We need neighborhoods to be neighborhoods. You all know who these individuals are.
Reverend Livingston, who is he referring to?
I don't know. We're talking about the okie doke here. That's in the hood, trying to pull the wool over your eyes. Look, Rahm and Eddie, first of all, Eddie was illegitimately hired by Rahm to be his yes man. And then Rahm is talking about that we need to report these murders, but yet and still he covered up the murder of Laquan McDonald to win an election. And here's the other part. He's sitting on $500 million of HUD low-income housing money for most of his administration. I'm telling you right now, I was talking to the cops when we were doing our Lakeshore Drive shutdown and Wrigley Field March last Thursday. I said, wouldn't it make a difference if someone had a decent place to lay their head down at night? You know, wouldn't it make a difference if they had heat in the wintertime and running water in the summertime? These monies have not been spent yet, but yet still in that $1 billion TIF slash slush fund, those monies are going out to his developer cronies, you know, at tens of millions of dollars at a time. And so there's a great deal of hypocrisy when you see Rahm's crocodile tears. They're bloody because he wiped them with his hands. They have the blood of so many folk on them.
Reverend, I want to continue along those lines because what we just heard from the police chief here is really a call to community. And here's the question that I have. What does the community want? You know, when we watch these reports that are coming out from Chicago and you see, you know, 2-second sound bites from residents who are saying, we want to be safe. But what does that mean? What are the residents asking for?
You know, I had a nephew who was shot in the head, paralyzed on the right side of his body, and you know, he was a father, married, and everything else. And, you know, these tragedies don't escape any of us, right? And so, you know, we want to be safe. You know, I mean, I live in the hood. Here's what I want to say to you. I was suited up the other day, you know, suit and tie, and I'm in the hood. There's a little girl about 3 years old with her mother, and she looks at her mom and says, Mommy, he's DCFS in Chicago. That's Department of Children and Family Services. I said, wow, what a worldview to have at this age. And how do we help reverse that and let her know that every black man in a suit is not a part of the system that is basically raising her from time to time. So the problem is complex. The components are there, but the root of the corruption is when you have a situation where individuals want to keep the segregation alive. And what we're trying to do is to intentionally desegregate this city. That's going to be a real key to help everybody, because once we all understand that we're one people, we must end this tale of two cities and have justice for all Chicagoans. It's not easy to do, but it has to be done. And so we have to fight the opposing forces that do want to maintain the segregation, the status quo.
Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston is a pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church and the president of the Coalition for a New Chicago. Reverend, thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? You leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance.
In our ongoing look at the criminal justice system, we're going to hear a story about your rights while in prison. Does a convicted prisoner have the right to freedom of speech while they're incarcerated? More specifically, does a prisoner have the right not to be a snitch? In 2010, Mark Burns was serving time for manslaughter at Coxsackie Correctional Facility in New York State when he got hurt working in the prison commissary.
I was doing inventory in the commissary, and as I was putting some of the canteen away on the shelf, a spaghetti can came down and hit me in my eye. which was witnessed by a corrections officer who is a steady, which means that he was there every single day working in the commissary. He's the one that wrote the report and came down to the hearing to testify where the injury was sustained from.
What guards wanted him to say about the injury was that it was the result of a physical assault by another guard. They wanted him to frame their colleague, according to Mark, and serve as an informant.
I was very influential as far as, you know, people needing me. I was altruistic in nature, trying to help people, you know, better themselves about rehabilitation. So I was called down to the office. They told me that since I knew so many different people, they wanted to know where drugs is coming in, maybe weapons around the facility. I did not have any of this information.
But Mark refused to play along. And as a result, he says guards retaliated by placing him in solitary confinement for 7.5 months. Mark was eventually transferred to another prison where he filed a lawsuit against Coxsackie Correctional Facility. He claimed the guards violated his First Amendment right to remain silent.
The Department of Corrections, they like to take things in their hand, which I mean by law and abuse of authority, basically. It happens on a regular basis in there.
In December 2017, Mark was released after serving 19 years for his crime. And after a judge initially ruled against him in the case he brought against Coxsackie in 2013, this past May, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals sided with Mark. Andrew Cohen, a senior editor at the Marshall Project, brings us this case in point. And he explains what this case means for a prisoner's right to remain silent.
I think this goes on quite frequently, where guards approach an inmate and they ask the inmate to be an informant, to be a snitch. What's remarkable here is that the episode comes to light. And most importantly, from my perspective, you get a federal appeals court ruling, the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in May, ruling that Mr. Burns had a constitutional right not to become an informant. And when guards asked him not just to be an accurate informant, but to essentially lie and inform about things he did not witness or see. So you have now new precedent in the federal judicial system that is pretty significant in terms of protecting other inmates who may be in this situation, not just in the Second Circuit, but perhaps around the country as well.
You know, you assume the loss of freedom when you are incarcerated, right? That's the whole point of being incarcerated. But I don't think you assume the loss of your constitutional rights. Andrew, I'm just wondering, is that what also happens when you're incarcerated? Do you need to
absolutely
fight in order to maintain them? It's stunning to me.
Yeah, absolutely. You lose almost every part of every constitutional right, or a little bit of it. But none of us have an absolute First Amendment right. We have a right to remain silent, right? We hear that in the TV shows, but it's not absolute. If a prosecutor gives us immunity and we don't testify, we could be held in contempt of court. When you get sentenced, when you get convicted, when you go to prison, you lose a lot of rights. And what the prison officials in this case said was that there was a penological interest in basically having this play out the way it did from the prison's perspective, that, you know, guards should be able to ask inmates to inform. And if they don't inform, there should be the ability to punish them in some fashion. And that's essentially what the court rejected, saying that, you know, whatever constitutional rights a prisoner has, whatever First Amendment rights to remain silent somebody has, or Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent, there are some limitations to the way that officials can intrude on those rights.
And Andrew, you know, one of the things that struck me too is that the law is different depending on who you are, I guess, right? I mean, don't guards have immunity in this case, or what is their situation?
Sure, they had immunity and they relied on that immunity and they were protected by that immunity. They were not punished as far as we can tell. In fact, one of them who is alleged to have done this is still at the facility and for all we know was never disciplined. The Second Circuit that issued this ruling in favor of Mr. Burns, recognizing his constitutional rights, also said that even though he had a constitutional right to remain silent, there was going to be no punishment, no liability for the prison or the guards. So the law is still set up to protect the corrections officers in this situation. Now, if something like this happens again a year or two down the road where there is this recognized constitutional right, it may be a different story. In other words, these guards in New York and in all of the jurisdictions covered by the Second Circuit essentially are put on notice now If they come to an inmate and they say, we want you to snitch for us, and we don't really care if you're accurate or honest enough in your snitching, that could be the sort of constitutional violation that does generate some sort of a money damage. Mr. Burns did not win his case in that sense. He didn't get the money at the end of the day. He didn't get a finding of liability, but he did, for all the inmates who come after him, have this recognized constitutional right not to speak.
Andrew Cohen is a senior editor for the Marshall Project. Thanks for being with us, Andrew.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
We're going to go back now to 1974. That's the year that a man named Ron Stallworth joined the Colorado Springs Police Department. And at the time, he was the only black man on the force.
I had no intentions of being a cop for an extended period of time. It was just a means to an end for me at that moment.
Ron had another idea for how his life would play out.
Go to college, get a degree, become a high school PE teacher, put all this other nonsense aside. A year into it, I realized, A, I was having too much fun, and B, I was making twice as much money as a college graduate at that time who was a teacher.
So he stayed on the job. In 1978, Ron came across a classified ad for a local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. The Colorado Springs Police Department was concerned about Klan activities at the time, and Ron decided to go undercover and respond to the ad. Not long after, he got a phone call from a Klan member named Ken Odell. And just a warning that Ron uses some offensive language here.
From the very first phone call I had with Ken Odell after I wrote the note telling him that I hated Mexicans, Spics, Jews, Japs, da-da-da-da-da, when he called me about a week or two later and said, I got your note. You have some very interesting ideas. Why do you want to join the Klan? And I repeated that, and then I thought I'd spice it up. And that's when I said, my sister is dating a N-word, and every time he puts his filthy black hands on her pure white body, it makes me cringe. It pisses me off. I want to do something to stop that abuse. His response, you're just the kind of guy we're looking for. when can we meet? So that moment, Ken was hooked. The challenge from that moment on was to reel him in tighter so that any doubt in his mind would not arise or would fall by the wayside. And that was where Chuck came in.
Chuck was a white undercover narcotics cop. Chuck is not his real name, but the one Ron uses when telling his story. And for face-to-face meetings with Klan members, Chuck pretended to be Ron Stallworth.
Chuck had to carry on everything I was doing on the phone in person to solidify that hook that we had planted, that I had planted in Ken. When you're undercover, the first minutes of that undercover assignment are very vital. You have to be convincing for that person to trust you enough to commit the criminal act or whatever it is that you're trying to engage him in. And if he is not trusting of you and believing who you are or what you say you are, you're not going to go anywhere.
What were you feeling when you were going through this, when you were actually involved in the case?
Talking to David Duke or any of those guys, I had to put on a performance over the phone. I had to convince them through my voice, through my words, through the inflection of tone that I projected those words, I had to convince them that I was one of them or wanted to be one of them. And that was the big challenge. By simply talking to someone on the phone, can you convince them that you are a white supremacist, even though you're black and hate their guts? Can you convince them to the point where they will start cooperating with you and give you the information you were seeking?
Ron was so convincing that members of the KKK never caught on. His story remained classified until he retired from the force in 2006. Ron's work helped the Colorado Springs Police Department foil a bomb plot, identify Army personnel who were in the Klan, and exposed where the local group kept their money. Today, when people talk to Ron about how he infiltrated the KKK, they're still often skeptical that a black man could have done it. His colleagues 40 years ago said the same thing.
When I asked for the use of Chuck, his lieutenant said it won't work because the minute Chuck walks in the door and starts talking to them, they'll know that they have been talking to a black man on the phone. My response was, what does a black man sound like? The response I got was dead silence. I asked again, what does a black man sound like? Silence. I've often been asked, did you talk like a white man? Did you change your voice? Did you alter your voice? And the response is no. I talked to them on the phone exactly as I'm talking to you right now. When you're undercover, you don't disguise your voice. You don't do anything like that because you have to remain as true to your true identity as you possibly can, because if you try to alter it in any way, unless you're extremely good, you could slip up, and that could be the difference between whether you walk out of the encounter alive or not. So you always be who you are, and I was Ron Stallworth talking just like I'm talking now.
This week, director Spike Lee is bringing Ron's story to the screen in the new movie Black Klansman. I sat down with Ron as well as John David Washington, the actor who plays him in the film. John David says he found it easy to relate to questions of how a black cop like Ron could infiltrate the KKK using his regular voice.
You know, it's interesting about the white voice. I mean, I went to a private school. You know, I would go into bar mitzvahs, went to a black college. I have family from the South. I spent summers also in Italy. So what am I supposed to sound like? You know what I mean? I have all these different experiences that are a part of me. I've been called the N-word at 10 years old in North Carolina. So I know different languages. I feel like Ron was speaking the language of hate to infiltrate it. You know, so there was like, just like you speak Spanish, you speak French, where, you know, you had to be able to speak hate to be able to get in with these guys, and he was able to. So a sap white voice or whatever, I didn't think about it that way at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously Ron didn't either.
We're also in a moment right now where a lot of what came up in the film, a lot of the issues that came up in the film, so many issues. I have like big notes here just wanting to ask you about everything from, you know, what it was like navigating being a black man in that moment. There seems to be this duality, right, both of the character and the person, particularly when you start the film and there's the Stokely Carmichael speech, and you're there as a cop, but you're also there with fellow black Americans, and in that moment wanting to sort of feel like you're part of it, but you're also on the other side of it. And I'm wondering, what was that duality like for you as a police officer, and what was that duality like for you as the actor playing that?
John David did a good job of expressing that emotion. If anything, it was underserved. It could have been emphasized a lot more, because the real incident that I had on that occasion undercover in the bar monitoring Stokely's speech, there were a lot of so-called ghetto celebrities that were in the bar, the drug dealers, pimps, prostitutes, people of that nature, and a lot of black citizens, upstanding members of the community who were there as well. And I was a uniformed police officer. I was a little bit concerned, this being my first undercover assignment, I was a little bit concerned about people in the audience recognizing me from my uniform day-to-day work, where I had written a ticket here or had an encounter there. So I had that apprehension going in. Never having worked undercover, the butterflies were in my stomach because this was the first time being undercover. So Stokely gives his speech. He starts his speech. Very powerful speaker. The man was dynamic. And he starts talking about the conditions that we as black people were under at that time. Now, I'm a black man first before I was a black cop. And when I take that uniform and badge off, I am still a black man in America.
Yes, sir.
So yes, sir. I'm listening to Stokely's speech, and he's talking about the white man has done this, we need to get guns and everything, and I'm thinking to myself, that makes sense to me. As a black man in America, that makes sense to me. And when they started yelling right on and giving me, giving him the approbation of right on and preach, brother, and black power, all of a sudden, my hand went up, and I said, right on. And then it dawned on me, you're undercover. You're a cop. You can't be doing this. And I put my hand down. I got caught up in his speech, in his rhetoric. He was very powerful, mesmerizing. And he demonstrated on that night the power that a person can have simply using words.
John David, when you're preparing for this role, what are you tapping into?
It's sort of a process. It's a gumbo, you know. It's of the varietal sense. You know, I was my way in, I guess, was music. I didn't listen to any hip hop or R&B for almost 3 months. You know, I went to sleep to Soul Train. You know, I got to know some of, you know, Ron listened to. I tapped into some of my uncles. You know, my mom. I got a lot of help on, you know, what bands to listen to and things of that nature. And then, you know, in those times in that discovery, I saw a couple documentaries. The Black Panther mixtape was incredible. And just understanding what was going on in those times first, even before I spoke with Ron, was important to me. Knowing that I'm in a Spike Lee film, I don't think anybody could have told this story besides Spike Lee, Jordan Peele, because of the tone of it, you know, and not to make it gimmicky and not to make, again, like sort of presentational to where it takes away from the root of what was going on here and the serious issues that happening. Because of the way it's packaged and delivered, the message, it's enjoyable. It's Friday night at the theater, you know, but at the same time, this is happening right now. And it's been happening. This is a generational issue, you know. So understanding all of that, it was liberating, knowing that I'm going to be taking this performance. What I give will be well taken care of by who's presenting it, and Spike Lee. So just be on it. And I owed it to this man sitting next to me here to play it as true as I could. And to almost what happened, the hardest part of it, really, all that research and all that time I spent talking to him and everything, all the information I gathered, is to let it go on game day. It's to let it go when he yells action and trust the process that my instincts with the research will take over and be what's best for the film.
As we said, and you just said, actually, John David, that this is something that is still happening. Yeah. We're still having these conversations. We're still seeing Black Americans shot and killed by police. Yeah. The movie is coming out almost exactly a year after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm, yeah. You guys had that at the end of the film, which I thought brought you real close to where we are today. Absolutely. There was no opportunity to say,
oh, I think this about from how it started to that, too. You're seeing the generation tied in, like the generations.
It was powerful to see that. I'd love to hear from each of you about the significance of this moment.
Well, let me say this, too. I got to spend, I did another film as well, playing a police officer. Well, not too often do we get to see or hear the perspective of men and women of color on that side of the force. You know, it's a thankless job. It really is. And so often we hear about the police brutality, but there's some police officers that are doing their job the right way, that are serving the right way, that are about their community. I feel like that's extremely heroic. I mean, I know he doesn't like me for me to say, but what Ron did is heroic. So I'm saying that to say, I hope men and women that are protecting and serving properly the right way, they really do care. We'll go see this movie and stand up and clap for yourself and know that you are represented. That was sort of my mandate going into it, to make sure y'all were well represented. Obviously, Ron first, but everybody that looks like Ron, too, protecting and serving the way he did.
As a retired police officer, 32 years in the business, I'm very proud of my profession, very proud. It served me well.
When you look today and see what's happening.
It troubles me when I look today to see what's happening, to see how often it happens and to see how it is directed, primarily at people of color, primarily blacks. That bothers me. The so-called blue wall of silence that you hear about is real. It does exist. We as cops tend to rally around our brother officers when they come under attack, because that could easily be one of us. We as cops tend to strongly dislike or hate the fact that the civilian population never sees things the way we see it. You're not exposed to the things that we are exposed to. And so we tend to take this attitude that, who are you to tell me I'm wrong in handling the situation that I did when I slapped this person around when I shouldn't have, but I did? Who are you to tell me that's wrong? You don't know what it's like to be out there, to have to put up with this, to be called a pig like you see in the movie, to be mistreated verbally, and in some cases, physically. Who are you as a civilian to come at me? So we tend to rally around those officers that come under attack and want to erect this wall of silence to protect them. I was in that moment when I was a police officer. I believe that. It literally took me some years to move past that to where I am today. And I can criticize and attack my fellow officers when they are wrong. And I have lost friends in the police profession. Some were very good friends. I've lost them because I've taken the stand, because I won't stand with them in support and defend officers who are violating the law. I won't do it.
John David Washington, Ron Stallworth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Ron Stallworth is a former Colorado Springs police officer and subject of the new movie Black Klansman. John David Washington plays Ron and is the star of Black Klansman. The movie is out in theaters this weekend. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.